to Eurovision, a podcast series that explores the extractivist gaze of European institutions and policies as a way to look beyond these extractive practices to the possibility of thinking and doing otherwise. My name is Audrey Sanson, part of the artist duo Fraud.
With myself, Francisco Gallardo, and in our practice, we invested in building critical spatial literacy.
In this case, into the inscriptive operations of the EU's Critical Raw Materials Initiative. Today, we will be talking with Dr. Jennifer Telesca about how marine policymaking has contributed to the accelerating extraction of maritime life. And in a more recent article, Fishing for the Anthropocene, Time in Ocean Governance, she denounces the role of managerial capitalism, armed with the bleak yet powerful persuasive tools like visual charts, scientific models, and statistical formulas, which together, and I quote, plan, measure, and quantify time as an exercise of power at sea. So we wanted to discuss with her the focus of the book, which is ICAT, and how it has managed and administered extinction, which is the focus of the book. But first, we sought to ask Dr. Jennifer Telesca if she would introduce the protagonist of the book, which is often rendered invisible by managerial processes. And so here we will pay homage to the protagonist.
Great. So the bluefin is probably one of the most consequential sea creatures in the Mediterranean basin. So here we have a creature that was fundamental to the rise of empire since the time of the Phoenicians. The bluefin is the largest of all tunas across the globe, the bluefin in the Atlantic. And this is one of the fastest fish at sea. So they quite literally just dart like a bolt of lightning across the ocean. And they've been tagged. That shows that they can cross all the way from the Western Atlantic near the US and Canadian Maritimes and travel all the way to the other side on the Eastern Atlantic to reach the 8-mile stretch of the Strait of Gibraltar to enter the Mediterranean Sea. Some tagging results have shown that they can cross the Atlantic Ocean twice in a year, depending on their spawning habits and migratory patterns. They're able to not only travel long distances across the ocean, but they can also dive all the way down to where the ocean becomes black, icy cold, in order to be able to hunt, mate, play with her mates, whatever the case may be. And unfortunately, the vast majority of people are completely unaware of what remarkable creatures these are. So in my experience in the over 10 years now that I've been working with this animal, when I mention my work, the vast majority of people might know that there aren't too many left and that the bluefin sells for a tremendous price at auction. This is the most expensive sushi money can buy. And it's always deeply unsettling, but yet revealing how alienated people are from the everyday life world of sea creatures. You know, just to also add here too, this is a creature that is not like cold-blooded cod, but yet not like a warm-blooded dolphin or whale. This is a creature that's somewhere on the evolutionary continuum between these two creatures. So in any case, what I try to do in the book is at certain parts, just remind the reader what an extraordinary creature the bluefin is. And yet the lengths that the technocrats, the fishery scientists, even the marine advocates have to go in order to drown out her majesty in order to be able to carry on the work of trade.
Thank you for that introduction to our protagonist. And I think in a way, this is a good bridge to think about precisely how that work of decontextualization and of erasure and of demajestification, if you will, is happening on the level of ICAT, which is the, of course, the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas, also dubbed the, what is the other name for it?
International Conspiration to Catch All Tunas.
That's a conspiracy to catch all tunas. Yeah, exactly.
And so perhaps by way of introduction to this institution that I think is less well known, interestingly, probably less well known than the extinction of tuna, and yet so tremendously central to that extinction. Could you briefly introduce how ICAT functions and how it was established?
Sure. So I think the really important part to note is that the discussions about the emergence of an institution like ICAT emerged in the early 1960s at a time when maritime nations were already well aware that we had an overfishing problem on our hands. And when ICAT forms in earnest, so this is formally a treaty that enters into force in 1969. By the time it forms in the late 1960s, I think it's really important for people to understand that ICAT was both born of and presents itself as the crisis of overfishing. And half a century later, the plight of these sea creatures has not at all improved. The question then becomes for me, when I first started this project, was here we have an institution that in name performs itself as a conservation-minded body, but yet in practice does not achieve these goals, at least if we understand conservation in a broad, generalizable way. And so I spent 3 years in the field going to ICAT meetings, traveling through its networks, another two, conducting follow-up interviews. And effectively what I learned was that the institution that is mandated to conserve creatures on the high seas is actually doing the job that has been asked of it by international law, which is to say that ICAT is entrusted to collect member states so that they might fish as hard as possible in order to grow their national economies. And as a result, then, what's conserved here are not creatures like the bluefin, but the export markets of the member states that sign up to this treaty. And I think this is important because it alerts us to the fact that it's not just that ICAT member states have overseen the slaughter. It's not just that they've witnessed the slaughter. It's that their practices have provoked it. And, you know, it's quite easy in broader discourse to intuit that the capitalists emerging out of the oil and gas sector are contributing enormously to the climate crisis. But less well acknowledged, if acknowledged at all, is the fact that representatives of state, technocrats, fisheries scientists, the marine advocates, diplomats are quite literally at the driving wheel in provoking the slaughter. That's the general focus of the book. And just to also share a little bit what work ICAT does, so that the member states are quite busy conducting multiple meetings throughout the year on all of these various creatures that ICAT is entrusted to, quote, manage. Yet the most important meeting every year happens in November when nation states come together and effectively decide the rules of trade for the coming year. And the rules of trade that matter most are the quota, the total allowable catch, and how those quotas are allocated. You know, think of it in more layman's terms, it's the pie, you know, is the total allowable catch. You know, so how big is the pie going to be? And who's going to get how big of a slice is the real core of the work that this institution does. And also to recognize that ICAT's secretariat is based in Madrid, Spain. So we have the landlocked city, what some people regard as the second largest fish market in the world after Tsukiji. And Francisco Franco, the former dictator, actively lobbied in order to ensure that ICAT would be headquartered in Madrid, that it's precisely in this nationalist bravado of thinking Spain as this great maritime nation, you know, rich in stories of the Spanish Armada. These ideas of empire are central to the very formation of this institution.
Certainly, the imaginaries put forward by the dictatorship in their propaganda series were very much as you describe. And I think that it's, of course, not a coincidence that ICAT is centered in Madrid, which used to be called the Puerto Pesquero, which is, as you say, very ironic as being a landlocked city. In your book, you very much describe, as you just have alluded to now, how ICAT has essentially managed extinction, and that the very species and other species that they were set to save, which maybe we'll come back to later as also a problematic concept in itself, but that the species that they were supposed to manage towards saving, they have saved the market abundance of the creature or the market presence of the creature, but not its presence in the ocean. So the locale of where and what has been saved is slightly shifted from the species to its market presence, and in this kind of grand abstraction that they perform yearly in very tedious, long-winded conferences. Perhaps you could explain a little bit more specifically how ICAT has administered and managed this extinction through what you discuss as these regulatory regimes that have effectively accelerated extinction. This is really quite important. It's much the opposite of what we would expect from a regulatory body. And you say that they have accelerated extinction through exterminatory regimes of value. So could you expand a little bit more on what this value regime is, how it's defined, and also what is occluded by these valuation systems?
Sure. So some of the perspective that I bring is as someone who's trained in anthropology. And so when I was in the field, my first clue that this was in effect an international trade organization above all else was paying attention to the very language that's used to describe these animals. So first and foremost is this language of a fish stock. I've written elsewhere where I trace the genealogy of this term as rooted in both as a biological asset on the one hand, right? So here the idea being like a stock traded on Wall Street. Also critically important is the way in which stock also references what we might understand here as a racialized form of capitalism, if we think of stock as population. So when someone uses the phrase, right, Mary is of good stock, right? She's of good lineage. And so you can see the way in which this kind of language, which is used not just by the policymakers and the fishery scientists, but also by the environmentalists, this is widespread, normalized, taken for granted, really everywhere in discourse on fisheries. And that tells us something really important about the dominant mode in which people are relating to the animal, first and foremost, as commodity. So in addition, the language then becomes a window within which we might better appreciate how people who are entrusted to care for these creatures are relating to the animal. And then part of what I started to realize throughout the course of the research was that some of the very core legal guiding principles, like the very grammar of fisheries management, relies on what people refer to as maximum sustainable yield, MSY, effectively a juridical formula based in statistical science that was invented by US diplomats as a mechanism to outmaneuver poor states who didn't have the statistical tradition or expertise to be able to put together recommendations based on these kinds of scientific formula.
I think this segues really well into the next question that we had in mind. You really brilliantly also throughout the book explain how something that is presented as an objective neutral tool like maximum sustainable yield is actually really a political tool of, and also of political bargaining and trade. You also mention in your book how a significant proportion of the quota distribution of ICAT is given to the EU. And so through this regime of having the means to make these types of statistics, or also this notion of the historical catch, which is quite central, is really fascinating to see how these methods are put in place that are perceived, or I should say communicated, as neutral and scientific are actually quite political and not neutral at all. So in your book, you also talk about how this is embroiled, how these types of quota distributions and also maximum sustainable yield is embroiled in political bargaining and trade. I like how you mention, I'm going to quote you now, when you mention how rights to fish were thus chips that delegations played in the broader political game of wrestling for control over borders and natural resource markets. So could you expand a little bit about this notion, or how you actually witnessed this, I think, firsthand by being in many of these meetings, this notion of political bargaining and trade and how that plays out in ICAT?
I can speak certainly to the role of the EU here, which is to say, one of the very first things that I learned when I was in the field was, I remember someone said to me, what the EU is to fisheries, the US is to oil and gas. I think it's really important to differentiate between each of the member states as well, and to acknowledge that delegates widely use this language of referring to ICAT as a game, right? This was not my language, this was theirs. Again, I take this language very seriously because it reveals an awful lot about what's going on inside of these regimes. So I take game as important, not because I subscribe to a reductionist kind of game theory analysis, but rather that it's really important to take the social economies of unfolding in spaces of ocean governance very seriously. Because part of what is also going on in these games is an assertion of the status, not only of individual players and of individual delegations, but also of the status of ICAT as a whole, as a world player. And so some of the chips that you mentioned, Audrey, I mean, I also had a very high-ranking delegate say to me at one point that it wasn't just, in this case, the bluefin that's on the table of negotiation. And he said to me, the idea here is, right, you take our fish, we don't give you bananas or coffee. And so part of what's going on here is that, you know, and there's stories, actually, you can find them on the internet, where one year in the 2000s, there was a holdup in deciding what that total quota allocation was going to be, because there was some wrangling behind the scenes between the US delegation and Morocco, which actually had nothing to do about bluefin, but had to do with exports of US automobiles. So there's this sense in which it's not just commodities, both wild and grown, but some of whom, some are also that are manufactured. And so zones like ICAT become spaces for low-level state bureaucrats to kind of do the work of intel that's required, that trickles up into other diplomatic realms. And so I think it's important to understand then that ICAT is not an isolated unit, but rather forms part of a larger constellation of institutions that are working toward figuring out how to manage global economies.
Perhaps as a kind of a closing for your very compelling and powerful contribution, could you expand upon the recommendations that you gesture towards in the book, such as the rejection of the hegemonic regimes of value, and also an ocean of value that moves away from saving, tragedy of the saber, towards more about multi-species respect?
Sure. I realized too, you know, as much as I've been with this material, I think one of the guiding assumptions that I'm making emerges out of some socio-legal scholarship that suggests that law and society are not separate, hermetically sealed spheres. but rather law is like language, a window into understanding the value systems of a society. And so in many ways, part of what I try to understand then is for us to figure out how to change that legal system, we have to change the values. In other words, we have to reject the idea that there's a hierarchy of being. We have to reject the idea that there's a hierarchy of value. We have to reject the idea that there's, you know, some kind of presumption that the bluefin is, and like any other fish really, is just a passive animal awaiting human consumption. And part of what is going on in ICAT, as well as in some of the more recent field work that I've done at the UN at its headquarters here in New York, is the recognition of how human-centric, how speciesist this law is. And, you know, to the point where the language, if we, you know, were to backtrack to maximum sustainable yield, you know, quite literally in 1958 declared explicitly that fish are products purposed for human consumption. You know, so how would we then go about rejecting this hierarchy of value? And I think really there's two ways to answer that. So one of which I alluded to earlier, which is, you know, rejecting the idea that the bluefin is first and foremost a product divisible by units, and that we might instead re-engage and reimagine and no longer detach ourselves from the majesty of these creatures, right? In the sense that I do think if people actually had some sense of what they were actually eating, not to reduce this at all to individual human consumption, but rather if we were to create a system that valued all beings, I mean, imagine what that might look like, right? And so, you know, I think the other important part here too, which is about the role of marine advocates. So this is looking at the environmentalists, looking at what the environmental journalists were doing in order to raise public awareness about the plight of the bluefin. You know, I realized while I was doing the research that there's this dominant narrative throughout. And this is true not just of the bluefin, but this is, you know, save the whale and save the California spotted owl and save the rainforest. And it's this logic of what I refer to as the savior plot is very central to the conservation movements, not just in the maritime sector, but elsewhere. And so the savior plot itself relies on a colonialist white savior as if there is a hero out there to rescue damsel in distress or some other innocent victim. And this is a narrative very common in Anglo-European traditions that we all very well know. In addition to, you know, all of the toxic politics and very fraught modes of so-called management, in addition, we have a public that's totally ill-informed about sea creatures and people in the public sphere whose very job is to inform the public have also advanced, adopted, taken wholesale this idea of the savior plot, and in so doing, contribute to the problem. And so the world I want to live in is one in which I don't want the bluefin just to be saved. I want a world where the bluefin, like all beings, is deeply respected. And that strikes me as a precondition to ever save the animal. Right. So I should also say, too, that ICAT member states manage not only the bluefin, there's a whole other host of creatures. So swordfish, shark, various kinds of seabirds, turtles, et cetera, that ICAT manages. And yet for artisanal fishers, right? So if you're Ghana, for example, going to an ICAT meeting, a big chunk of your population are artisanal fishers. When I was in the field, some of the delegates from Ghana suggested that figure was as high as 10%. and the recognition that you have people who rely on fishing for subsistence, and yet the preoccupation of ICAP member states remains a creature that is meant for the consumption of global elites. So the whole institution itself is directed at ensuring that global elites can consume their fish as if there's just this endless cornucopia, as if there's this endless abundance of marine life. It's really important to recognize that there's about a dozen small tunas. So this would be like mackerel, bonito, dolphin fish, that many artisanal fishers, including ones on West Africa, regularly catch. And because there are no statistical analyses, they don't count how many they catch. ICAT does not manage the catch of these creatures, even though from the period from 1980 to 2010, the small tunas made up 28% of all the catch in the Atlantic Basin. That's a lot. So you can see that ICAT in many ways is preoccupied with ensuring that lucrative export markets are conserved so that consumers on the other end don't think there's a problem here.
I think that world, it needs to be thought now more present than ever. Like before, we were speaking with the director of the Coalition for Fair Fishes Agreements, and she was stating something that we may suspect, was that with the current situation of COVID, recovery is gaining new grounds. What before was growth, now it's going to be recovery. The agenda of the blue economy, of the blue capital, the blue growth is going to, without the efforts of the thinking otherwise, it's going to be steamrolled and imposed without much thought.
Yeah, it's quite an urgent agenda.
If I could just add one thing, one way to extend this idea of respect then is the environmental justice movement is also, because it's localized, it's a recognition that we must figure out ways to adequately care for our common home. And it seems to me that care for our common home from an environmental justice perspective requires this kind of deep respect for the interdependency of life, for the sacredness of life, for the fact that global elites are not the great exceptional being on the planet, and to really imagine what a world outside of that could look like.
I think that's a good place to end. Certainly, we were left with the thought that the way in which conservation is managed, the very premise of value, is very problematic, and that the entire premise of the institution that manages this so-called conservation is in itself flawed from its inception, and that it is only through a multi-species respect that we could even begin to imagine that this kind of management could maybe even function. Because otherwise, of course, if we're simply counting, one could always make more efficient or less efficient counting or be liable to corruption or other systems, so that it's only really with a different valuation system that's predicated on respect that one could imagine that this could begin to work. Thank you so much.
Eurovision was commissioned by Arts Catalyst and Radar and developed in collaboration with the Istanbul Design Biennale. Eurovision has been generously supported by the Canada Council for the Arts, Arts Council England, and Action Culturelle Española.